Chapter 13 Taking a Stand for Your Family.
One of the greatest threats we face in the 21st century is not a terrorist attack or an ecological catastrophe, but an attack on our homes. The enemy would love nothing more than to ruin your relationship with your husband or wife, your parents, or your children. And too many homes are being destroyed through strife, or lack of commitment, wrong priorities, or bad attitudes. If we're going to have strong, healthy relationships, we must dig our heels in and fight for our families. The Old Testament records a time when Nehemiah was rebuilding the walls of Jerusalem. The walls had been torn down years previously, and the enemy was coming against God's people, against their homes, their wives and children, while the men worked on the construction crews. The situation got so bad that Nehemiah instructed his men to work with a hammer in one hand and a sword in the other. He encouraged them, "Men, fight for your sons, fight for your daughters, fight for your wives, fight for your families." He went on to say, "If you will fight, then God will fight." I believe God is saying something similar to us today. If we will do our part and take a strong stand for our families, God will do His part. He'll help us to have great marriages and great relationships with our parents and children. And certainly not everyone will get married, but if a man or woman choose to marry, two issues must be settled first. Number one, as a couple, we are committed to God. We're going to live a life that honors Him. We will be people of excellence and integrity in all that we do. The second settled issue must be that as a couple, we are going to be committed to each other. Occasionally, we may disagree, say some things that we shouldn't, but when it's all said and done, we're going to get over it, and we will forgive and move on. Leaving is not an option. We are committed to each other through the good times and the tough times. If bailing out of the relationship is an option, then you will always find some reason to justify it. "Joel, we just can't get along. We're not compatible. We tried. We just don't love each other anymore." The truth is, no two people are completely compatible. We have to learn to become one. That means we may have to make sacrifices. We may have to overlook some things. We must be willing to compromise for the good of the relationship. Stick with your spouse and make that relationship work. As one lady said, "My husband and I got married for better or for worse. He couldn't do any better, and I couldn't do any worse." When you do have disagreements, learn to disagree from the neck up. Don't let it get down in your heart. Victoria and I don't always see eye to eye, but we've learned how to agree to disagree. When you present your case, don't try to make that other person change his or her mind. Give others the right to have their own opinion. If you're not going to be happy unless they agree with you, you're just trying to manipulate your partner. You're trying to force your opinion on that person. And the better approach is to present your case, share your heart, and then step back and allow God to work in that person or that situation. As long as we're argumentative and we're trying to force our opinions, then there's going to be strife in our homes. Wherever there's strife, there's confusion. There's nothing worse than living in a home that's tense. Everybody's on edge. You feel that at any moment something could explode. You don't have to live that way. Do your best to create an atmosphere of peace and unity in your home. When you're tempted to pop off and say hurtful, critical things, the next time you have that opportunity, do yourself a favor. Take a deep breath. Pause about 10 seconds. And think about what you're going to say before you speak it. Words can cut like a knife. You may say them in a matter of seconds, but 3 months later, the person that you said it to is still feeling the sting. Solomon was the wisest man who ever lived. His book of wisdom encourages a husband to look his wife in the eyes and tell her, "There are many beautiful women in the world, but you excel them all." Solomon started his day off by praising and encouraging his wife. Men, you can imagine how our relationships would improve if we'd start complimenting our wives like that. Some women haven't had a compliment in years, not because they don't deserve it, but because they are not appreciated. All they hear is what they're doing wrong, how their dinner wasn't good and the kids are too loud. Listen carefully to the words and tone of voice you use with your spouse. Are you complaining all the time, telling her what she's not doing right? Or are you doing like Solomon, blessing, encouraging, and uplifting that woman? Well, you say, you don't know my wife. She's the problem. She's argumentative. She's hard to get along with. Maybe so. But if you'll start praising your wife, if you'll start telling her how beautiful she is and how glad you are to have her in your life, when you talk about the good, you will draw out the good. If you talk about the negative, you're going to draw out the negative. It's up to you. Men, learn to speak blessings over your wife, and you will see that woman rise to a new level. She will respond to your praise and encouragement. And your words don't have to be fancy or profound. Just simply tell her, "You're a great mother to our children. You're a great wife to me. I'm so glad I can always count on you." Understand, this is not an option. It's a necessity if you're going to have a healthy marriage. Like Solomon, get in the habit of looking at your wife and saying, "You are beautiful. There are a lot of pretty women, but you excel them all." And if you're a father, you need to make especially sure that you affirm your children. You have incredible influence over them. And every day, just as you bless your wife, bless your children as well. Look at each child and say, "I'm so proud of you. I think you're great. There's nothing that you can't do." Your children need your approval. You're helping them to form their identity. If we're too busy as fathers, we're never there, or maybe we're always just correcting our children without providing them the affirmation, then our children are not going to be as confident and secure as they should be. And certainly there are times when the father can't be there for the children because of other responsibilities, but do your best to keep your priorities in order, because no amount of success in your career can make up for failure at home. I've seen some men accomplish great things in the corporate world, but they did it at the expense of their children. Their children grew up without a father figure. Fathers, take your children to church. Don't send them. Be at their ball games as often as possible. Know who their friends are. Listen to their music. Children are looking for direction and guidance. When that young man comes over to take your daughter out on a date, be the first one at the door. Let him know there's a man in the house watching over that young lady. Parents, we have to fight for our children. If we will fight for them, God will fight with us. Years ago, at the largest game reserve in South Africa, they developed an overpopulation of elephants. The staff decided to take 300 of the youngest male elephants and separate them from their parents and other adult elephants. These young male elephants were transported to another national park, where the white rhinoceros reigned as the dominant king of the park. The rhinoceros has no natural enemies. Nothing stalks it, not even a lion, a tiger, a bear. The rhino is simply too powerful. The staff felt there would be no problem mixing the orphan elephants in with the rhinos. Over time, however, they began to find dead rhinos out in the brush. They couldn't understand what was happening, so they set up surveillance cameras to observe the park. Much to their surprise, they found that those young male elephants, the ones that no longer had a father or mother figure, had formed gangs and they had viciously attacked the rhino population. It's not even in the elephants' God-given natural instincts to act this way, but the lack of parental influence caused this strange, deadly behavior. I believe the same thing threatens our children. The reason that children get into trouble can often be traced back to the fact that they do not have positive role models in their lives. They don't have anyone speaking blessings over them and praying for them. They don't have father figures. And many don't have healthy, positive mother figures. And it doesn't mean the children are hopeless. It's simply a fact that without parental guidance, children sometimes do things that they might not otherwise do if mom or dad were around. We have a responsibility to reach out to children who don't have a father figure or a mother figure. Maybe you can mentor a young man or young woman. If you really want to be blessed, don't just fight for your family, fight for somebody else's family. Stand in the gap for that single mom or single dad. When you take your son out to hit baseballs, swing by and pick up that young man who doesn't have a father figure. Reach out to some other children. As you take time for others, God will always provide for you.
Chapter 14. Invest in your relationships.
If you want your relationships to thrive, you must invest in them by being a giver rather than a taker. Everywhere you go, strive to make relational deposits into people's lives, encouraging them, building them up, and helping them to feel better about themselves. And it's not always easy. Some people are difficult to be around because they tend to draw the life and the energy out of you. They're not bad people, they just drain you. They always have a problem or some kind of major crisis. They talk all the time, so much so you can't get a word in edgewise. By the time the conversation is done, you feel as though your emotional energy is drained. Difficult people don't make positive deposits. They're too busy making withdrawals. And please don't misunderstand me. It's okay to be down and discouraged occasionally. Everybody has a right to have a bad day. But if you do that all the time, that's a problem. You're not going to have good friendships if you're always draining the emotional reserves of the people around you. I like to think of my relationships as an emotional bank account. I have an account with every person with whom I have a relationship, whether a family member, a business associate, friends, even some people I meet in passing. I have an emotional account with the security guard at work, the man at the gas station, the waiter at the restaurant. Every time I interact with them, I'm either making a deposit or I'm making a withdrawal from that account. How do you make deposits? It can be something as simple as taking the time to walk over and shake a man's hand. How are you doing today? Good morning. Good to see you. Just the simple fact that you went out of your way to make him feel important made a deposit into his account. Your act of kindness built trust and respect. You can make a deposit simply by smiling at somebody, being friendly, being pleasant to them in just ordinary circumstances. When you compliment people, you're making a deposit. Tell that coworker, "That was an outstanding presentation. You did a great job." Tell your husband, "I appreciate what you do for this family." Or maybe your wife, "You make it so much fun to live around here." When you do these things, you're not merely giving a compliment, you're making a deposit into the account that you share with that person. At home, you can make deposits in your emotional accounts by giving your wife a hug and a kiss, telling her that you love her. You make deposits into your accounts with your children by spending time with them, by listening to your daughter when she's playing the piano, by going down to the park and watching your son skateboard. A subtle yet amazingly effective means of making deposits is by overlooking a fault. Maybe a coworker is rude. He jumps down your throat about some meaningless matter. But instead of retaliating, you let it go. The next day when he apologizes, you say, "Hey, don't even worry about it. I've already forgiven you. I didn't think twice about it. I knew that wasn't your normal self." When you do such things, you make huge deposits into your account with that person. Your stock goes up significantly on his scale. Perhaps one day you're a bit stressed out and on edge, and maybe you don't treat him as well as you should. You'll have plenty in your account to cover it. How do we make withdrawals from our relationship accounts? The most common way of making a withdrawal is through selfish behavior. When we're only thinking about what we want and what we need, we inevitably withdraw resources from our relationship accounts. We make withdrawals when we don't take time for people. You go into the office and just blow past the receptionist. You don't smile or even notice her. Whether your mind was somewhere else or you were just having a hard day, you just made a withdrawal from your account with that person. You lowered her opinion of you. Other ways we make withdrawals include those incidents in which we don't forgive, when we don't keep our commitments, when we don't express appreciation to someone that deserves it. Maybe somebody does something nice for you by going out of their way, but you take it for granted. You don't say thank you, or maybe you feel like you're too important to say something such as, "I appreciate your effort." Failure to appreciate the kindnesses of others will always result in a withdrawal from your account with those people. The problem in many of our relationships is that our accounts are overdrawn. When we make a mistake and we need a little mercy or a little understanding, that person goes to our relationship account and discovers it's already empty. Now we must live constantly on edge. Minor issues become magnified. We have to guard every little word we say because there's no reservoir of grace from which to draw in that relationship. We've exhausted the resources, and that's when little things suddenly turn into big things. For instance, you correct your teenage son, and seemingly out of the blue, he blows up. "Who are you to tell me that? I don't have to listen to you." Those statements are revealing that your relationship account with him is depleted. He's saying, in effect, "You haven't built trust with me. You haven't taken an interest in me. You haven't let me know that I'm important to you." If you're going to correct someone, or maybe you're going to offer some constructive criticism, you need to make sure that you've made plenty of deposits into your account with that person. Make sure you've earned that person's respect. In disciplining your children, ask yourself, "Have I encouraged him? Have I complimented her? Have I been interested in what he's interested in? Or have I simply been making withdrawals?" If all your child has heard for the last couple of months is clean your room, do your homework, take out the trash, tuck your shirt in, you are merely making withdrawals. And the truth is, parents must make many withdrawals during their children's teenage years, but you cannot expect to speak effectively into your child's life unless you first made plenty of deposits. You must invest in that relationship, nurture it, and build trust. And everywhere we go, we should be making deposits, whether at the grocery store, the ballpark, the school, or the office. Develop a habit of sowing good things into people's lives. Make it your business to help someone else feel better about himself or herself. Be interested in people. Take time to let someone know that you care. Go out of your way to show somebody that they're special. When you leave the office, instead of rushing out of the parking garage, take a few moments and ask the attendant, "How are you doing today? I'm so glad you're a part of this company." Encourage him in some way. Make him feel that he's important. Help him to know that somebody cares. Learn to appreciate people. Learn to say thank you. And just because someone works for you doesn't mean that you're exempt from expressing appreciation to that person. "Well, Joel, I pay him good money," or "I pay high enough taxes. I shouldn't have to thank that policeman. I shouldn't have to thank that school teacher. They should just do their jobs." No, learn to sow positive deposits into people's lives everywhere you go. I remember when I was at my father's house, he would see the mailman coming. Daddy would get a big smile on his face, and he'd say, "Well, looky here. Here comes the finest mailman in all the world." That mailman's countenance would lighten up. My father's simple compliment brightened that man's day. It didn't take a lot of effort, didn't require much of his time. He had developed a habit of investing in people and helping others to feel better about themselves. Your words have the power to put a spring in somebody's step. to lift them out of defeat and discouragement, to help propel them to victory. A simple deposit, just like my father made, didn't take more than 10 or 15 seconds. Learn to give compliments freely. Learn to be friendly and avoid anything that exudes the attitude that you're so important that you can't take time for somebody who's not up to your level. Instead, make everyone you meet feel important. Strive to make every person who you have contact with feel special. After all, every person you meet is made in the image of Almighty God.
Chapter 15. Being good to people.
Do you want to get more out of life? Here's a suggestion. Get up every day, and rather than trying to be blessed, do everything you can to be a blessing to someone else. If you will do that for 6 weeks, trying to be a blessing to someone every day, I believe your life will be filled with so many blessings, you won't be able to contain them all. I've discovered if I meet other people's needs, God will always meet my own needs. If I make somebody else happy, God will make sure that I'm happy. Every day, we should look for opportunities to be good to people. Maybe you can buy somebody's lunch, give someone a ride, babysit someone's children. Get in a habit of doing something good for someone every day. Don't make the mistake of living selfishly. That's one of the worst prisons you could ever live in. You were not created to be focused only on yourself. God made you to be a giver. The best way for you to be fulfilled is to get your mind off yourself and reach out to others. Learn to be good to people in your everyday life. When you go to the lunchroom, bring your coworker a cup of coffee back. You may be thinking, I'm not going to do that. He never does anything for me. But be bigger than that. Do it unto God. Don't miss an opportunity to do something good for someone. On the freeway, when traffic backs up, let that car squeeze in front of you. At the grocery store, when you have a large basket full of groceries, the person behind you is carrying just a few, let them go ahead of you. In the parking lot, when you pull up to that last spot at the same time as another car, back up and let the other person have that space. Prefer them over you. Be good to somebody. Victoria and I went to a restaurant where we'd eaten a number of times before, and we practically knew the menu by heart. We knew exactly what we wanted. We sat down, we ordered right away, and I was hungry, but it seemed to take forever for the cooks to prepare our food. We waited and waited, and it didn't make sense. The restaurant wasn't even busy. When the waitress finally brought the food, our order was not right. She returned my food to the kitchen. It was another long delay. Finally, I got tired of waiting and began eating off Victoria's plate. It was the worst service we had probably ever had in a restaurant. When it came time to pay the bill and leave the tip, I thought, God, now you just saw what happened. And I know you're a just God, and surely you don't expect me to leave a good tip. Almost immediately, I knew I was wrong. I said, okay, God, how about 5%? Let me tell you a secret. Don't ever negotiate with God, because you'll never win. I said, okay, God, how about 10%? 15%, that's the normal amount. God, you know that's the going rate. I should be able to do that. But I still didn't have any peace. I knew God was saying, don't miss this opportunity to do good. Don't miss this opportunity to show mercy. We can be good to people when they're good to us. That's easy. But God wants us to be good to people even when they're not so good to us. I eventually changed my attitude and thought, I'm not just going to give this girl a tip. I'm going to sow a seed into her life. I'm going to go the extra mile and be good to her. We left a $20 tip for a $30 meal, but we did it as sowing a seed. A few weeks later, I received a letter from that young lady. I had no idea that she had recognized Victoria and I. She didn't give us any indication that she knew us. Her letter began by asking, "Do you remember me? I'm the girl who waited on you at what was probably your worst restaurant experience ever." I thought to myself, I know exactly who you are. She went on to tell how she had been raised in a good Christian family. They went to church every Sunday, but in her late teens, her family was hurt by a leader in their congregation. Somebody did them wrong. The entire family now had given up on God, dropped out of church. Over the last year or two, they had been watching me on television. The waitress related in her letter, "I told my parents, I know these people are real. Something on the inside tells me they're sincere, and we need to get back in church." She continued, "Joel, when you and your wife came in the restaurant and we got your order all mixed up, most people would have gotten aggravated and upset, but you two were so nice and kind. And on top of that, you left us that big tip." She said that confirmed what I already knew in my heart. I went home and told my parents what happened, and now we've gotten our lives back on track, and we're at Lakewood every Sunday morning. Learn to be good to people. That's one of the best witnesses we can ever have. Now when I tip people, I tell Victoria, we're going to sow a seed into their life. Here's an opportunity to do good. When I leave that place, I want them to be able to say, that couple sure is generous. They sure are good to people. See, the world does not need to hear another sermon nearly as much as it needs to see one. Learn to give your time, your money, an encouraging word, meet a need. When you show love, you are showing God to the world. Don't worry about it if you don't get any credit. If that young lady hadn't written to Victoria and me, it wouldn't have mattered one bit. I would still feel that we did the right thing. When you let somebody in traffic in front of you, you may never see that person. When you give somebody $20 simply because you felt compassion in your heart, you may never hear back from them. But that's okay. God's keeping the records. He sees every act of kindness you show. He sees every time you're good to somebody. He hears every encouraging word you speak. God has seen all the times you went out of your way to help somebody that never said thank you. Your good deeds do not go unnoticed by Almighty God. When you study the life of Jesus, you'll notice that He always took time for people. He was busy, He had places to go, but He was always willing to change His plans in order to do good for somebody else. As He walked through the villages, people called out to Him, "Jesus, please come over here and pray for us." He would stop and go out of His way to bring healing to those people. One time they came up to Him and said, "Jesus, please come to our city. Our relative is so sick. You've got to pray for him." Jesus changed His plans and went that way. When they tried to bring the little children to Jesus, the disciples said, "No, don't bother Him. He's busy. He's too important." Jesus said, no, let the children come to me. And it's easy for us to get caught up in our own little world where we're focused only on ourselves. I've got my plans. Don't get me off my schedule. No, instead, learn to take time for people. Don't miss an opportunity to do good. Make a difference in somebody's life. It doesn't have to be something big. Often, small gestures of love and kindness can make a big difference. A women's group at our church makes blankets, and then the women embroider scripture verses on them, and they take them to cancer patients at MD Anderson Cancer Center here in Houston. Those handmade blankets remind the men and women struggling with cancer that somebody cares. The expression of love gives them an extra ray of hope. Those ladies are using their talents to do something good for somebody else. There are two kinds of people in this world, givers and takers. Be a giver, not a taker. Make a difference in somebody else's life. You are never more like God than when you give.
Part 4. Form better habits. Chapter 16. Feed Your Good Habits.
An old Cherokee tale tells of a grandfather teaching life principles to his grandson. The wise old Cherokee said, "Son, on the inside of every person, a battle is raging between two wolves. One wolf is evil. It's angry, jealous, unforgiving, proud, and lazy. The other wolf is good. It's filled with love, kindness, humility, and self-control." These two wolves are constantly fighting, the grandfather said. The little boy thought about it and said, "Grandfather, which wolf is going to win?" The grandfather smiled and said, "Whichever one you feed." Feeding unforgiveness, impatience, low self-esteem, or other negative traits will only make them stronger. For instance, you may complain frequently about your job. You're always talking negatively about your boss and how that company doesn't treat you right. Ironically, when we complain, we feel a source of release. It feels good to feed those negative thoughts, but the wolf we feed will always want more. The next time you're tempted to complain, ask yourself, "Do I really want to keep feeding this negative habit? Do I really want to stay where I am, or do I want to starve this complaining spirit and step up higher?" If you will start feeding peace, patience, gentleness, self-control, you will see those character traits begin to develop in your life. Make the better choice, and instead of complaining about going to work, learn to say, "Father, I want to thank you that at least I have a job. These people may not be treating me right, but I'm not working for man, I'm working unto you." When you do that, you're feeding the right thing, and the new habit begins to develop. And a habit is an acquired, learned behavior that we do without even thinking about it. It's almost involuntary. We've done it so long, it becomes practically second nature. If we have good habits, that may be fine. But sometimes our habits are keeping us from God's best, and we may not even realize it. Many of the habits we've developed stem from the culture we were raised in. If you grew up in a home where people were disorganized, sloppy, or always late, you may have formed some of those same negative habits. Or if you were raised around people who tend to be harsh, sarcastic, rude, you may have picked up some of that same behavior. You may not even realize that those attitudes and behaviors are offensive since that's all you've ever known. On the other end of the spectrum, other people grow up with positive habits such as neatness, godliness, cleanliness, and order. Many people have established positive habits concerning diet and exercise. Other individuals have a habit of getting up at a particular time and going to bed at a particular time. That will allow their body to rest and be refreshed. These are all positive, learned behavior patterns. Your habits, whether good or bad, will greatly determine your future. One study says that 90% of our everyday behavior is based on our habits. Let that sink in for a moment. From the time we get up in the morning to the time we go to bed at night, 90% of what we do is habitual behavior. That means how we treat people, how we spend our money, what we watch, what we listen to, 90% of the time we're on autopilot. We do it the way we've always done it. It's no wonder that if you want to change your life, you must start by consciously changing your everyday habits. You can't keep doing the same things you've been doing and expect to get different results. To become a better you, take inventory of your habits. Do you have a tendency to be negative in your thoughts and conversations? Are you always late to work? Do you worry a lot? Do you overeat? Do you give in to addictions? The good news is you can change. You can develop better habits. Most studies tell us a habit can be broken in 6 weeks. Some studies say you can break a habit in as little as 21 days. And think about it. If you will discipline yourself for a month or so and be willing to suffer through the pain of change, you can rid yourself of a negative behavior, form a new healthy habit, and rise to a new level of personal freedom. If you have a habit of not getting to work on time, change that behavior. People who get ahead in life are usually punctual. Why don't you get up 15 minutes earlier? Plan your travel so you can arrive with time to spare. Establish a new routine of being on time. And don't allow yourself to be late when punctuality is such an easy habit to develop. Or if you have a habit of eating a bunch of junk food and drinking several sodas every day, commit yourself to forming better eating habits. Don't go on a crash diet. Just change one small thing at a time. Before long, you'll notice a difference in your energy level as well as your personal appearance. How do we change a habit? It's easy. Quit feeding the bad habit. You have to starve your bad habits and start nourishing your good habits. I heard somebody say, bad habits are easy to develop, but difficult to live with. In other words, it's easy to pop off and be rude, saying whatever you feel, making cutting, sarcastic remarks. That's easy, but it's difficult to live in a home filled with strife and tension. It's easy to spend money that we don't have, charge everything on our credit cards, but it's hard to live with the pressure of not being able to pay our bills. It's easy to give in to temptation and do whatever we feel, but it's difficult to live in bondage, feeling guilty and condemned. On the other hand, good habits are difficult to develop. A good habit results from a desire to work and sacrifice, and sometimes a willing to endure pain and suffering. But good habits are easy to live with. For instance, it's hard at first to hold your tongue and overlook an offense when someone criticizes or insults you. It's hard at first to forgive, but it sure is easy to live in a home filled with peace and harmony. If you will be willing to be uncomfortable for a little while, so you can press past the initial pain of change, in the long run, your life will be much better. Pain doesn't last forever. In fact, once you develop the new habit, the pain often disappears. Friends, don't stay stuck in a bad habit. Make a decision that you're going to develop better habits. And to change, you must be consistent. You have to do it day in and day out. You need to form a no exceptions policy. That means no matter how you feel, no matter how much you want to go back to your old ways, you're going to stick with your new plan, no exceptions. That means you must be willing to press past the pain and discomfort at the beginning of your new regimen. After all, if you've trained your body in a certain way year after year, you've developed behavior patterns to which you've grown accustomed, don't be surprised if your body doesn't like when you try to establish these new patterns. But if you will discipline yourself and stand your ground, in a few months, you can form new habits and your life will be much more rewarding. Understand, once you get past that initial pain, establishing the new and better pattern will be much easier. Think of a rocket being launched into space. Liftoff takes an enormous amount of thrust. The majority of the energy expended in that launch is spent as the spacecraft breaks free of the Earth's gravitational pull. Once it pushes into outer space, it's much easier to keep moving forward. In the same way, when it comes to breaking bad habits, if you can just get past the first few weeks, it'll get easier and easier, and one day you'll be home free. Think about all the people you know that are trying to lose weight. The diet business is a multi-billion dollar industry nowadays. And although diets can be helpful at times, the long-term solution to keeping your weight under control is not to run from one diet to another. Most of the success achieved by those kinds of diets is only temporary. And unfortunately, most dieters end up regaining that weight and sometimes even more. The better way to get your weight under control and to maintain it is to establish new habits. Start exercising, start watching what you eat, when you eat, and how much you eat. And granted, it's not always easy, especially at first. You'll have to be extremely disciplined. And every time you resist a temptation, every time you make a better choice, it will get easier. And one day you'll notice that you're living healthier and more productive. Remember, in forming new habits, it will always be the most difficult at the beginning. You'll be tempted to turn around or return to your old routine, but don't give in. You will always have plenty of excuses why you shouldn't change. You can always find a reason to give up and just keep living the same way you've always been living. Don't be surprised when you're tested. Simply remember, the Scripture says there's no temptation that will come that you cannot overcome. God always has a way of escape. And so no matter how intense the pressure or how difficult it seems, you need to know you can withstand it. God will help you. He'll make a way of escape, but you've got to be willing to take it. In reality, it's not so much that we break bad habits. We must replace them. In other words, if you have a problem with worry, and your mind is always racing 90 miles an hour, worried about your children, worried about your finances, worried about your health, you need to recognize that worry is a bad habit you've developed. In most cases, you can't just decide to stop worrying. You have to replace the negative thoughts with positive, faith-filled thoughts. Then every time you're tempted to worry, use that temptation as a reminder to dwell on good things. The Scripture tells us to dwell on things that are pure, things that are wholesome, things that are of a good report. If you will replace those thoughts of worry with thoughts of hope, faith, and victory, then you will retrain your mind. Do that day in and day out, and before long, you will have formed a habit of dwelling on good things, and you will have broken out of that old habit of worry. The key to success is to find something that you can replace the negative habit with. If you habitually run to the kitchen and eat every time you're stressed out, find someplace else to go, something else to do. When you feel tense, go outside and take a walk. It doesn't have to be a 2-mile jog. Simply walk around the block or down the street. When you come back, stay busy and stay out of the kitchen. It's interesting. The Apostle Paul said in Romans 7, "The things I want to do, I don't. The things I don't want to do, I end up doing." Paul was struggling to do the right thing. In verse 19, he gives us insight into why he was having that struggle. He said, "For I failed to practice the things I desire to do." He was basically saying, "I haven't developed good habits in these areas. I'm not practicing what I know I should be doing." The truth is, we are all practicing something. The way to develop good habits is by practicing the right things. You may be good at losing your temper because you practice it a couple times a week. Some people are good at being impatient because they practice it every morning on the drive to work. I know people that are good at being negative because they constantly practice negative thinking. Remember, repetition is what forms a habit. That's what puts us on autopilot. So we have to make sure that we are practicing the right things. For instance, every one of us should be practicing forgiveness. The next time someone offends or hurts you, don't return evil for evil. Immediately forgive that person. Let it go and start practicing forgiveness. Let's practice being disciplined in our spending and making good financial choices. Many people are way out of balance in their finances because they've developed bad habits, such as spending money that they don't have and charging everything on their credit cards. It doesn't take a lot of wisdom to realize that paying 20% interest on a credit card is not a good thing. And some people are always praying for a miracle. They're praying for a financial breakthrough. And I say this respectfully, but often we don't really need a miracle. We just need to develop better spending habits. I know some people, if God blessed them with $1 million tomorrow, a year from now, they'd be in the same financial difficulty. They'd have the same problems. Why? Because they have not developed good spending and saving habits. Keep in mind, financial pressure is usually listed as one of the top 3 reasons why marriages fall apart. If you want your marriage to last, develop good financial habits. It's never too late to start doing the right thing. If you'll do your part, God will do His part. He'll promote you, He'll give you increase, but you first must be a good caretaker of what you have. The first step to overcoming any habit or addiction is to identify what's holding you back. But don't stop there. Make a decision to do something about it. Take action. Don't be too embarrassed to seek help. People these days struggle with chemical addictions, sexual addictions, all kinds of problems. Maybe an anger addiction. You just can't control your temper. Understand, you can change. Freedom is available. Don't believe that lie that you're stuck and you'll never get any better. God has already laid out a path of success for you. But you got to do your part and be willing to walk it out. The next time that temptation comes, the first thing you should do is pray. Get God involved in your situation. We cannot defeat bad habits in our own strength. Ask God to help you. When you feel your emotions getting out of hand, you're tempted to be rude and tell somebody off, right then, pray. Under your breath, God, I'm asking you for your help. Give me the grace to keep my mouth closed and the courage to walk away. Remember, your habits today will determine your future. Examine your life. Take inventory of your habits. When you find something that's not right, be quick to change. In the process, you will establish the habit of becoming a better you.
Chapter 17. Develop a habit of happiness.
Many people don't realize that much of the manner in which we approach life, our attitudes and our demeanor, is learned behavior. These habits have formed by repetition throughout the years. If we've spent years focusing on what's wrong rather than what's right, then these negative patterns are going to keep us from enjoying our lives. We acquired many of our habits from our parents or from the people who were around us as we grew up. Studies tell us that negative parents raise negative children. If your parents focus more on what was wrong, living stressed out, uptight, or discouraged, there's a good possibility that you have developed some of these same negative mindsets. The good news is you can reprogram your computer. You can get rid of a negative mentality and develop a habit of happiness. The Bible says, "Rejoice in the Lord always." One translation simply says, "Be happy all the time." That means no matter what comes our way, we can have a smile on our face. We should get up each morning excited about that day. Even if we're facing negative or difficult circumstances, we need to learn to keep a positive outlook. Many people are waiting for their circumstances to be worked out before they decide to be happy. "Joel, as soon as I get a better job, as soon as my child straightens up, as soon as my health improves." No, the bottom line is if you're going to be happy, you have to make a decision to be happy right now. Happiness does not depend on your circumstances. It depends on your will. It's a choice that you make. I've seen people go through some of the most unfortunate situations, yet at the time, you would never know they were having a problem. In spite of their negative circumstances, they remain positive, upbeat, and energetic. Other people in the same circumstances, and some in even worse situations, insist on wallowing in self-pity. They're down, depressed, discouraged. What makes a difference? It's all in how they've trained their mind. One person has developed a habit of happiness. She is hopeful, trusting, believing for the best. The other person has trained his mind to see the negative. He's worried, frustrated, and constantly complaining. If you're going to develop a habit of happiness, you must learn to relax and go with the flow instead of getting frustrated. You have to believe that God is in control, and that means you have no need to be stressed out and worried. You have to learn to be grateful for what you have rather than complaining about what you don't have. A habit of happiness boils down to staying on the positive side of life. One of the best things I've ever learned is I don't have to have my way in order to be happy. I've made up my mind I'm going to enjoy each day, whether my plans work out or whether they don't. When you have that kind of attitude, minor irritations or inconveniences that may have stressed you out will cease to be a source of frustration. You don't have to live all uptight. Understand, you cannot control people, nor can you change them. Only God can do that. And if somebody is doing something that's getting on your nerves, you might as well leave that up to God. Quit allowing somebody else's little quirk to get the best of you. Maybe if your husband is 15 minutes late, coming home from work and dinner gets a little cold, that ruins your whole evening. No, don't be so rigid and set in your ways. Life is too short to live it stressed out. Besides, prolonged stress can damage your health and significantly shorten your life. I don't want to die early because I got upset every time I was stuck in traffic. I don't want to live with knots in my stomach because some person is not doing what I want him to do or because my big weekend was rained out. It's not worth it. You can choose to be more flexible and have a more easygoing attitude. Think about this. 10 years from now, many of the things that you're allowing to create stress in your life won't even matter. You won't remember the fact that your golf game was rained out last Tuesday. You won't care about the fact that you got stuck in traffic. And sometimes, everything that can will go wrong. When you have one of those days, just dig your heels in and make a decision that you're going to keep a smile on your face, go with the flow, knowing that God is still in control. Victoria and I were aboard a flight recently, returning home to the U.S., when for no reason they upgraded us to first class. It was simply God's favor. We travel a great deal, so when I get back to town, I like to hit the ground running. We were scheduled to land in Houston around noon, and I'd already scheduled the rest of my day. I wanted to go eat lunch at a favorite restaurant, play with our children, go work out, and do a few other things. I had it all planned out, and I figured that since Victoria and I were going to be the first ones off the plane, we could get through customs and immigration rather quickly. The plane landed, and just as I had planned, Victoria and I got off very quickly. Evidently, 4 or 5 other international flights had landed just prior to our arrival, and the customs area was as crowded as I'd ever seen it. The line was backed up all the way to the jetways. At least 1,000 people must have stood in that line. One look, and I knew that it could take an hour or two to clear customs, and that was going to throw my plans completely off schedule. I decided I wasn't going to get uptight. I was going to believe for some of God's favor. I kind of joked with Victoria, saying, "Watch this, Victoria. Somebody's going to come up and take us right up to the front. God, please give me your favor. God, please cause me to stand out in the crowd." I prayed on and on. The line seemed to surge even with more people, but I remained confident. I was expecting God's favor, and so I had stood off to the side, and momentarily I got out of line so I could look up toward the front. That's when I noticed a woman coming toward me. She was dressed in a uniform, wearing a badge, and carrying a walkie-talkie. She was some kind of official. I told Victoria, "Here she comes. She probably attends Lakewood." I was so excited, I just knew she was going to take me to the front of the line. Sure enough, that woman came right up to me. She said, "Sir." I smiled real big and said, "Yes, ma'am." I was already reaching for my bag, ready to go to the front. She said, "Sir, would you please get back in the line?" I said, "God, that's not what I was praying for." But my whole day went like that. Not one of my plans turned out. But thank God I've learned to be adaptable and adjustable. I've made up my mind I'm going to enjoy my day whether I get my way or not. Why don't you make a decision that you're going to be happy even if you get stuck in traffic, even if a waitress spills something on your new coat, or even if you have to wait in a long line like that? Take an honest look at your life. Are you as happy as you know you should be deep down inside? Do you get up each day excited about your future? Are you enjoying your family, enjoying your friends? If not, what is it that's stealing your joy and causing you to get upset? Why are you worried? Identify what it is. Take inventory and then take it one step further. Begin retraining your mind in those particular areas. Many times you can make a small change, a minor adjustment in your attitude, a minor adjustment in how you treat people, or even a minor adjustment in how you respond to problems, and it will make a huge difference in your life and in your level of joy. Years ago, the Russian scientist Ivan Pavlov did an experiment with some dogs. He studied their behavior and how they responded to certain situations. Every time he fed them, he rang a bell. When the dogs saw the food, they became excited and started salivating. They couldn't wait to eat. Over the next couple of weeks, every time Pavlov fed the dogs, he made sure he first rang that bell. After a while, the dogs associated the ringing of the bell with the presence of food. A few weeks later, Pavlov decided to try something different. He started ringing the bell at odd times when he wasn't feeding the dogs, just to see what they would do. Interestingly, every time he rang the bell, even though there was no food within sight or smell, the dogs began salivating. In their mind, they were about to eat. Pavlov called this a conditioned response. Something similar can happen to us. We can allow ourselves to develop all sorts of negative conditioned responses. For instance, we get stuck in traffic. Almost certainly, our blood pressure shoots sky high. We get all upset. Or maybe at the office, somebody doesn't speak to us, or somebody intentionally ignores us. Instead of letting it go and giving that person the benefit of the doubt, we get offended. We've conditioned ourselves to respond in a certain way. We've allowed these negative mindsets to steal our joy. To develop a habit of happiness, you must retrain those negative responses. When you get up in the morning, you may feel discouraged or depressed. You may not feel like going to work. Instead of thinking, nothing good ever happens to me, this is going to be a lousy day, break out of that rut. No matter what those circumstances look like, say, this is the day the Lord has made. I'm going to enjoy it. I'm going to be happy today. Speak that out by faith. Every time you do, you are retraining your mind. You're forming a new habit of happiness. Just as we can form negative habits of defeat, discouragement, bitterness, we can get in the habit of enjoying every single day. Friends, there's too much sadness in our world today. Many people are even sick physically because they're living so stressed out, so uptight, so worried. I realize depression may be caused by a chemical imbalance, but I see too many people dragging around defeated and depressed just because they always focus on the negative. They focus on their problems, on what's wrong rather than what's right, or what they've lost or what they can't do rather than what they can do or what they have left. Change your focus. You can have a small problem, but if you stay focused on it, it will seem to get bigger and bigger. Don't magnify your problem, magnify your God. Step out of doubt and step into faith. Get out of that discouragement and come over into joy. Make a decision that you are going to live your life happily. And I don't mean that you feel on top of the world all the time. That's not realistic. I'm talking about being content. In fact, one definition of joy is calm delight. That means you're at peace. You have a smile on your face. You're excited about your future. And sure, you may have some problems. We all have obstacles to overcome, but we know that God is in control. We know that He has us in the palm of His hand. The Apostle Paul said, "I have learned how to be content no matter what state I'm in." Think about it. He said, "I have learned to be content." In other words, this didn't happen automatically. I had to train my mind to stay in peace. I had to train my mind to look on the bright side. I had to train my mind to focus on the good. We must do the same thing. Happiness is not going to fall on us. It's a choice we have to make. Being positive doesn't necessarily come naturally. We have to make that decision on a daily basis. Our mind, left alone, very often will drift toward the negative. If we don't stay on the offensive, little by little, we grow more and more sullen. We don't smile as much. Soon we're not as much fun to be around. We start to find fault. We start to get critical. No, instead, refuse to allow those negative habits to take hold. When you get out of bed in the morning, put a smile on your face. Set the tone right at the start of the day. If you don't set the tone, somebody else will set it for you. You need to realize when you smile, it's an act of faith. When you smile, you're sending a message to your whole body announcing that everything is going to be all right. If you will develop this positive attitude of faith, you will sow a seed for God to work in your life. Following the devastation of Hurricane Katrina, I was watching a special news program one day as reporters were interviewing people in New Orleans who'd gone through the hurricane. Person after person told their story, and most of them were extremely negative and bitter, blaming other people, blaming the government, even blaming God. One young lady stepped up to the microphone, and I could tell immediately that she had a different attitude. She had a big smile. Her face almost seemed to glow. The reporter asked her, somewhat sarcastically, "Okay, tell us your story. What's wrong?" "Nothing's wrong," she said. "I'm not here to complain. I'm here to thank God that I'm still alive. I'm here to thank God that I have my health and thank God that my children are okay." The reporter was taken aback. Everyone else had been complaining about not having electricity, not having water. It was more than 100 degrees. They had no air conditioning. The reporter probed further, "Well, what about your power? Do you have any air conditioning?" The woman said, "No, I don't have any power. I don't even have my home. It was swept away in the flood." Then she smiled as she said, "I'll tell you what I do have." She reached down and picked up her Bible. She said, "I have my hope. I have my joy. I have my peace." With a radiant countenance, she continued, "I know God is on my side." That woman chose to take a negative, unfortunate situation and turn it around. She refused to tune into thoughts of self-pity. She refused to allow her negative circumstances to steal her joy. She was saying, in effect, "I know God is still in control of my life. He said a little sparrow would not fall to the ground without him seeing it. So I know he's watching over me." Train your mind to see the good. Get rid of any negative, conditioned responses. Everybody around you may be complaining, but you can find the good in every situation. If you'll do what the Scripture says, you can indeed be happy at all times.